This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/beherenow.
After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nickturn and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nickturn and Duncan Trussell.
Welcome to the CSM Podcast with David Nickturn. Creativity, spirituality, and making a buck. Blending spiritual and temporal realities, joining heaven and earth. We will be talking with a variety of manifestors, individuals who have, in one way or another, clarified their vision, created an offering, and brought that offering to the marketplace. Let's see what we can learn from them as we each move forward towards solving our own life puzzle. Facing the challenge of living in the spirit, in the body, in the world, in this time. If you're interested in supporting the CSM podcast, please visit beherenownetwork.com/David.
Okay, well, greetings, everybody. This is the CSM podcast. I'm David Nickturn. I have a very, very special guest today.
Special needs.
Yeah, it's a young guy, but he used to follow me around all the time, all over the place. And, you know, I finally figured out what the basis of that was. So this is my son, Ethan. Ethan Nickturn, everybody. And welcome, Ethan.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Yes, I am definitely your neediest guest of all time. If you gauged it out over the last 41 years, I've definitely demanded more of you than any of your other guests.
Yeah. So. Well, you've given more too, Eth. So the irony of this is that both Eth and I are kind of in the same realm as perpetuating and propagating Buddhist teachings in various contexts and working with people on that. And also, Ethan has a podcast on this same Be Here Now network. So sometimes I'm on his podcast, sometimes he's on mine. But right now, especially, it occurred to me that it would be a great time to talk to Ethan, because everybody's always asking me, well, what does Ethan think about this? What does he think about that? He's got a kind of quite a potent little influence out in the world there of people buying stocks that he's in favor of and changing their opinions about political candidates that they used to like and all the rest of it. So I thought I'll just ask Ethan directly and just put it right out there. So we're going to sort of talk about pretty much everything today. So let's start. Let's start with Ethan. What do you think is going on?
let's start small, huh?
Start with the little picture. What is going on?
Yeah. I mean, it's at least the last 4 years, I would say. I actually just got a tweet from someone I know who's kind of a cool, engaged Buddhist in Durham, North Carolina. And she tweeted at me, 4 years ago this weekend, I did a meditation retreat that you taught in North Carolina. And I was just thinking of like four, so that would be spring of 2016, the sort of gearing up and ramping up of that election season. And I would say it's interesting because I would say that period, like the last 4 years, feel like cosmically crazy to me. A lot of, I don't think we can understate how weird it is who's the president right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, harmful, yes, but just like Back to the Future 2 was a movie where they go back to an alternate 1985 and Biff Tannen has gambled his way into being the lord of everything. And they specifically said that the character was made after Donald Trump. So this is weirder than the plot line of Back to the Future 2. And we're now 3.5 years into that weirdness. So I never
heard that before, Eth. What a perfect metaphor.
Yeah.
Wow.
No, it does feel like we've sort of jumped, you know, a timeline, and then everything that's happened since, you know, what happened in the Shambhala community in 2018. Now coronavirus, something very cosmic or cosmological, some kind of ripening gravitational transition that's bigger than us seems to be happening.
And when you try to wrap your mind around it, does it feel like something that's, let me give you a couple of multiple choice, benevolent? Is there some kind of benevolence to it? Or is it ominous? Is it dark?
Yeah.
Is it intelligent? You know, how would you characterize it?
I have been thinking about this a lot, that there's, you know, as Buddhists, as Mahayana and Tantric Buddhists, like, there's basically two problematic ways to narrate your experience. And there are, you know, 17 million different subsets of each, and they weave together. But one is to be basically overly eternalistic, or to claim something solid and positive, you know, and cheerful at the center of everything, like some benevolent deity or just fate or destiny or some to kind of move your storytelling about the experience, and like that sort of like it's all good, you know, we're all one, you know, that sort of because it feels like it's actually evasive of the mm-hmm. moment. And then I would say,
so that's eternalism, to be clear, right?
That's eternalism. And right, okay. I would say that's the better of the two, just because it at least gives you a little energy to show up to the moment. Mm-hmm. The much more common one, which also has 17 million different subsets, is nihilism, a kind of cynical narration of like, we're fucked, the universe is fucked, you know, people are originally sinful, you know, humanity is broken, it was always going to be this way, it's never going to get any better, everybody's corrupt, you know, and
the end of the species, which some people are talking about.
Yes, and there's an apocalypse.
Homo sapiens is extinction event.
Right. So, and not that either of these has some intelligence to it. The cynical narrative usually picks up a lot of clear criticism about what's going on now, or it knows how to put the overly optimistic in its place, you know, it kind of gives it a little needed smack in the face and says, kind of pay attention to what's actually happening. But either of those is problematic because it claims a kind of direction to experience the universe that's basically just about the person who's narrating feeling more solid, right? More like, I know what, if everything is fucked, then I know what's happening. If there's a benevolent God, then I know what's happening, you know? And we're really trying to hold the space of returning to a basic state of not knowing. But discerning within that space.
Discerning within not knowing. There's a good one.
So we can talk in terms of like, it looks like this thread or this influence is coming out or that influence is coming out. We can say things about relative reality that are like, look at this kind of causal stream or look at this influence and how that's playing out. But I don't know if I believe in a benevolence to the universe. You know, I mean, I think Mahayana Buddhism, I think the Shambhala teachings, they definitely talk about a benevolent awareness that lives in every being that could be tapped into.
And every fiber of every being.
and every fiber of
like at a molecular level.
Yeah. So I guess that means we have a benevolent belief in the universe. Mm-hmm. I definitely think this transition has tremendous opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say like that I've played it out, and there is one direction this could go, especially with coronavirus. And I think kind of there's nothing subtle about the belief system that Donald Trump inhabits, whereas the people who've inhabited that belief system before tend to have a lot more subtlety. So he says the loud parts loud. And I think coronavirus also says the loud parts loud about what really matters, how our system actually works, like, you know, what is really should be prioritized in human life. And it's happening everywhere simultaneously. You know, we're having like a 9/11 sort of event, although it doesn't really have an enemy, so that's new. And it's happening everywhere, not just in the country, but across the planet is being affected in some way. So I think of this time next year or 2 years from now, like there could be a real, real coming together of humanity. That's definitely one possibility, because the sort of, you know, think about the source material for, you know, one person kind of getting on the path of awakening or mindfulness is usually heartbreak or one little part of their life or one big part of their life falling apart.
Mm.
Now that is happening everywhere simultaneously.
Yeah. When things fall apart, the whole thing falls apart.
So
that's a good new book title. When the whole thing falls apart.
Well, call Pema and tell her that has to be her next book. Okay. When the whole thing falls apart.
So it's interesting because you're framing it with eternalism and nihilism as the kind of, you know, these are basic Buddhist teachings that we both probably talk about all the time. I haven't found that I've had to go outside of my Buddhist grid to describe what I think is happening in various aspects of the situation. It's not like, oh God, I didn't think of this, you know. Whole planetary systems have come and gone. Civilizations have come and gone. It's all declared as impermanent in the Buddhist view. Individual people come and go. It's impermanent. Within the impermanent realms, we're sort of training to pay attention, as you said, to the kind of precision or the sharpness, the acute perceptions within the not knowing. You know, is there anything different about this, and that makes you think, oh man, I need to invent another yana for this?
No. I mean,
another vehicle. You know.
Yeah. No, I mean, if there's anything, I mean, you know. I think we both do what we do because we think Buddhism is great. You know, I would say that there's a lot of Western and modern fields of inquiry and study that don't disagree with Buddhism or the best parts of what Buddhism says, but make it more robust or give you, you know, like, you know, for example, studying the human nervous system through neuroscience or evolutionary biology makes you understand why a lot of Buddhism makes sense from a kind of organism standpoint, right?
Studying, so it's beefing it up.
Yeah, it's beefing it up. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, studying like Western ethics or activism, you know, makes a lot of sense in terms of understanding how Buddhist ethics could be applied to kind of modern social situations, right?
Yeah.
Studying Western art forms or modern art forms makes Buddhism more interesting in terms of looking at how the mind expresses, right? So,
sure. So
I think modern media, they add a lot to classic Buddhism, but they're not really changing anything. You know, there is one thing I'd say, you know, and I think this is where the Shambhala teachings are headed and, you know, the really, you know, hopeful and insightful parts of them were headed. There's not a clear theory in classic Buddhism about how social consciousness actually works. And almost all of classic Buddhism is the study of individual consciousness, or the Bodhisattva teachings how individual consciousness could interact with and possibly benefit other individual consciousness. Mm-hmm. But there's not a lot in classic Buddhism. It's clear the Buddha and other people like touched on social issues,
you know?
But in terms of like how a group of people get together and create a culture or create social karma or something like that, or social awakening, the theories of classic Buddhism are much more subjective, which actually I think is a good thing because it's more scientific that way, actually. Mm-hmm. But there's not a lot of robust discussion in classic Buddhism about like, you know, how an entire political or cultural system would work in terms of the various consciousnesses involved.
Sociology, in essence.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm struck lately, as you know, I'm conducting a course with the students I work closely with, and we're looking into Mahamudra teachings, particularly Trungpa Rinpoche's, you know, Essentials of Mahamudra. And I'm struck by how completely cohesive the most advanced instructions are with the most beginner instructions right now. Yeah. Like there's really kind of no difference.
Yeah.
You know, and I just saw Mingyur Rinpoche on the internet, and he was basically giving, you know, what we would call Dzogchen or Ati instruction style, very open, very relaxed. You know, he gave what's essentially, I'm going to just jump the shark here, and even if people are not familiar with this, he gave essentially what's a Mahamudra style of meditation instruction. So for those of us out in there who haven't encountered this yet, this is kind of the most, you know, after you study this material, then you're kind of, you're done, you've cooked the Buddhist dinner, all the courses, and you have the view of the most progressed view, which is amazingly close to what happens when you come into it, and people are just telling you pay attention to your breath, you know, be aware of what's going on. So the instruction that he gave, and he just did this on internet, so I'm going to just also reiterate it, is don't meditate. That's the first instruction. Now that's shocking to people who come and go like, I just paid $500 for this course on meditation. Now this Tibetan Lama who's supposed to be a 1,000-year-old lineage is saying, don't meditate. Okay, I want my money back first. Second, if that instruction stood by itself, it would be very quixotic or, you know, paradoxical or hard to fathom. But the second piece of it is don't wander. Mm-hmm. So you're not supposed to meditate, but you're also not supposed to mind wander, which is what you do when you're meditating as a beginner. You say, I'm mind wandering. I'm going to come back to paying attention. So you actually do have an exercise. And the third one is don't fabricate anything. Mm-hmm. So those are, you know, as far as I understand, those are from, you know, I think the ninth Karmapa or somebody like that. They're essential Mahamudra instructions. Now, if you said that to somebody, you're giving them really good meditation instructions. Mm-hmm. Would you ever give anybody instruction like that?
Sure. I mean,
a student?
I've heard it in a reversed order. Don't meditate, don't fabricate, and don't wander even for an instant. I bet the source material is the same. I think it was the ninth Karmapa, the head of that, the Kagyu school of Tibetan Buddhism. But I mean, when you're giving simple instructions, context is everything, right?
Yeah.
So that, I mean, that's the idea. But there is this notion, right? It goes along for me with the story of, there's this story that one of the early ways that Buddhism came to Tibet was that this sort of chest with the teachings fell onto the roof of the palace of the king. This was around the time of Padmasambhava. So this was the first transmission of Buddhism into Tibet. The teachings were transmitted in this chest in two ways. One was 6,400,000 verses, and the other was three lines.
That says it all.
Yeah. But I mean,
which were the three lines? The ones we just said or something?
No. I mean, the three lines kind of weren't a meditation instruction. They were a description of the entire path of working with the mind. So the first was one is introduced to the nature of your mind. Mm. One decides decisively on this unique state or this way of being, and one proceeds directly with confidence and liberation, more or less. Right. So
Swaha.
The three lines that strike at the heart. So, those systems of Mahamudra and Mahaati, which are the two lineages of, and I like that we're both talking about this and Back to the Future Part Two, same conversation. Those systems were, are considered the most pithy and direct teachings in Tibetan Buddhism, and you could be given to them immediately, but there was always an assumption that one was also practicing all of the other, maybe not as a daily meditation, but was familiar with all of the teachings on compassion and the teachings on ethics and was studying the different views, etc. So there's always, I think with any wisdom tradition, there's always a sense of complexity meeting a sense of simplicity. And, I think some people's minds are already quite complex. So if somebody actually needed simplicity and just said, like, do this, that's also many of the schools that descend from Dogen, my understanding in the Soto and Rinzai Zen traditions of Japan and now the Western world, have that same sense of simplicity. You're just introduced to Zazen. Maybe you do koan practice. Maybe you do Shikantaza, which is sort of their version of don't meditate, of Mahamudra practice. And there's not a lot of, other robust practices. I do find, though, that people a lot of times need to really, alongside understanding that simple view of working with mind and awareness is there and is at the heart of everything. People need methods of compassion. People need methods of working with emotions. People need self-compassion practices become really important in the modern world.
Can you say a little more about that?
Sure. So that's the interesting thing is sometimes it's always fascinating that when you look at some of these hierarchical systems of Tibetan Buddhism and other forms of classic Buddhism, it's often this notion that the teachings on the nature of mind are kind of the higher teachings, and the teachings on how to generate loving kindness or compassion for self and others are more preparatory, I don't think it's good to view the different practices that we do as hierarchical. It's more that they're just contextual. Like, what is the what is the view and intention of doing each of these practices, and when for each student might it become useful?
Yeah, well said. And I think in going into these teachings, I find myself wanting to emphasize Mahayana more because it's easy to kind of, there's a little mind trick that anybody can play, really, of kind of taking a big view, and I'm noticing myself doing it and other friends doing it. Okay, I got the big picture here, but what about the guy down the street? Or what about, what about the person whose restaurant just closed? And it's one thing to say, okay, it's all part of, a very large tableau, but to move into the specificity of what's happening now and the kind of just temporal challenge that it's providing for people with their everyday lives is you can want to get away from that. And one way to get away is into the big view, the eternal, the kind of big picture view. And you, as contrasted to, a nurse in Manhattan right now, you see these people going through the ringer of compassion. And like, what does compassion really mean? There's a person like can't breathe right there. And there's somebody else out in the hall that you don't have a ventilator for.
Yeah.
So you have to be able to put those two together, in a meaningful way. It's hard to do right now. It's challenging. Who knows how much energy you have for it all. Have you felt at all tired or depleted during this time? Or how are you feeling energetically?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, my main experience during this shelter in place is being with my family, and you know, that's been more tiring than usual because, you know, both my wife and Marissa and I are working from home, and you know, we have a young daughter who always asks about Nuji
and Grandpa Nuji.
Do people on your podcast know that you're Nuji?
They know that I am Nuji, but they
that's your name. Yeah,
they may or may not know that's my nickname, but I suspect by now many people do. The little gathering I'm having is called the Nuji Sangha.
Oh, nice.
You know, yeah. So, Grandpa Nuji, yeah, that's one of my favorite identities. But I see, peering over your transom, that the intensification for family life and child rearing is has gone up an order of magnitude, right?
For sure, for sure. Yeah, because we don't have help. So, you know, there are long days where, you know, going back and forth between sort of trading off the work that we need to do and then, you know, trying to be present for her. It's also great in that way because you really get down to spending time together and things that matter. Certainly, you know, in my own way, definitely trying to be there for others, for students who study with me, for kind of the virtual communities that I'm part of. So, yeah, it's been tiring and depleting. It's, you know, I also feel, you know, definitely like one of the lucky ones. You know, I'm not out of a job right now. I'm not a frontline healthcare worker. You know, I really think we need to reexamine, you know, what jobs are valuable in our society, and
yes,
and
indeed,
how to help them. But yeah, sure, it's tiring. It's also what I've experienced and what I've been working with a lot of people on is just not quite knowing how to feel. So it's a kind of tiredness where you just kind of don't know where you should be putting yourself. So, and part of that, I think, is the basic, you know, human response that when you do want to generate compassion at a time like this, your basic reaction is, if you're generating compassion towards somebody, right, your mind goes towards them and your body also wants to go towards them as well. And that's the wrong thing to do. So it's, I think that is fritzing a lot of our brains, and it's depleting, you know, and then there's grief, you know, there's, you know, knowing people at one or two orders of magnitude, you know, and just overhearing, like, I don't know anybody directly who's died. I mean, I know people in my orbit, but you know, you overhear conversations. I was overhearing my wife talking to a client about some work in Italy, in Milan, and he just kind of casually mentioned, yes, my wife's father passed away from the virus, and just like, and it's like, you know, just receiving that, you're like, wow, you know, there's just a lot going on, even if it doesn't end up being the thing that does our society in, which I'm hopeful and optimistic it won't be, there's still just, yeah, it's depleting for sure. So I think part of my practice is just, and I think this is nature of mind, when body feels depleted, just know body is depleted.
You know,
that there's nothing more to do than that other than rest if you can.
Yes. And I think also some of us are experiencing reserves of strength and kind of resourcefulness. I some people seem quite energized, actually, that I talk to. Almost as if like they are in a retreat and they are having, you know, challenging time working with all of it, but that there's a source of energy that's coming out of it that is almost, you know, propulsive in a way.
Yeah. That's been a lot of people's experience too. It's clarifying, you know, I mean, I mean, I don't know a single person who isn't thinking like a lot of the things I used to do kind of have a bullshit, you know, grind quality to them, and not having to do that, you know, there's some liberation.
Yeah. Wow. Well, and then we go into one of the, you know, interesting things about, it's generational in some way. I mean, it's interesting. My generation was socially and politically active, you know, and then this kind of, you know, Eastern spirituality jag hit, and that, you know, some people kept both threads going. I would say there was one thread that went a little bit away from the social and political activism, more towards the kind of spiritual, you know, potentially spiritual bypassing aspect of developing a lot of that kind of training. But you, I think, are, you know, in a way, you're you and you're smart and you're personally interested and active in terms of the sociopolitical fabric, and you always have been. And, you know, I think, but also I think people are looking for leadership in that zone of how to integrate the spiritual view with the sociopolitical view. So it's just not a bunch of angry, you know, lefties storming the castle. And now, okay, that's, here's another style of aggression, you know?
Right.
So the blend of the Buddhism and the social activism, I almost think you're, you know, like a kind of, you know, a leader and a spokesperson in a way. Can you give us your view without any cynicism at all, with heart, with compassion? Again, what the hell is going on sociopolitically in our country and around the world?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, I think it's very multifaceted, so I don't really know. But I also think it's important. I mean, I feel it's important as a meditation teacher, as a Buddhist student and teacher. I never bought the view, and have increasingly not bought the view, that one's job is to stay neutral about these things. I mean, neutrality is simply not a Buddhist teaching. Like, anybody who says neutral, there's no place that
right.
even appears as a concept, you know? Right. So what I think became increasingly important for me is to demonstrate how I'm thinking through political issues, and to be vocal and transparent about that, rather than to like let other people, you know, do that, or to take this view that I think is a false view and says, like, again, Buddhism, I think there's a confusion between neutrality and equanimity usually. And the notion of, like, if you're going to be a spiritual teacher, like, stay in your lane and don't have any interest in the political world, because I think non-interest in the political world is a political view. It's actually a conservative political view. It empowers that which wins when people don't participate. And every single time people don't participate, conservative views win. I mean, that's actually the karmic chain.
Well, there's a profound formulation right there. When spiritual practices teach disengagement, conservative forces have a seeded victory, and you essentially are contributing to that by your philosophy of non-attachment or disengagement has become a very active contributor to the victory of certain point of view.
Yeah. And you can claim not to have, you know, you can, that's the other interesting thing, right. is you can, any of us can otherize ourselves from the situation, you know, and claim, you know, but that's a basic Buddhist principle, is that if you are perceiving a situation, it's not saying that it's your fault, but you are implicated by anything that you perceive. That's a basic.
Oh, you're implicated by anything you perceive.
Yeah.
Write it down, everybody. That's a good one. By anything you perceive.
You're part of it, meaning. That
yeah,
it's,
no, I like
it's,
it.
It's an,
yeah.
it's an interplay between right. perceiver and perceived, subject and object. It right. does not mean it's your fault, you
right,
know?
Right?
Like, but right. it means that there's an actual, you are part of the system.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
I mean, so none of us can claim a system that we are not part of. That would be a basic problematic view from a Buddhist standpoint, right?
Yes.
If you're observing a system, you are within the system that you're.
Yes. Yes. So there is no real non-attachment. If you propose non-attachment, in a way, that's a form of attachment to a sort of negation of attachment, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, most of the time when people, and this is where the whole notion of spiritual bypassing came from, most right. of the time the energetic or active quality that most of us actually go for when we use the word non-attachment is rejection, you know, or it's a subtler form of aversion. But
which is really ignorance. It's ignorance.
Yeah. But real non-attachment, if we're actually looking at that as a positive awakened state, is a flexible mind, you know, a mind that is part of what it's perceiving and interacting with, but can also let things flow and change when they no longer serve, you know.
Right.
So non-attachment is a practice of you have to actually be participating in a system to even be trying to practice
right.
what non-attachment actually means. So, I mean, that's where my basic views come from. Now, then, within that, you know, we can debate a lot of different things and about how democracy should work or what policy choices are the most awakened, et cetera. And, you know, I have evolving views on all of that. But part of what I see now is that we can't turn this into like a dualistic or both sides situation, because mm-hmm. it's become increasingly clear that one of the major American parties, it's not that they have views that I disagree with. That would be fine. That's what democracy is all about. They do not believe in democracy. The Republican mm-hmm. Party does not want democracy to continue. Mm-hmm. And if you look at this, like we talked about it the other day, if you look at the federal government, at least, there's four main bodies that are chosen either directly or indirectly by the people. You have the presidency, right? You have the Senate, you have the House of Representatives, and then you have the Supreme Court, if you think about that as being the union of the president and then the Senate choosing the members of the Supreme Court, right? But mm-hmm. but the notion is, if you vote for a president, you're also voting for who they might appoint, and the Senate too, because Mitch McConnell blocked Barack Obama's choice to the Supreme Court by not even bringing it to a vote. But those two entities, you do have a connection to the Supreme Court. So which of those entities are controlled by the will of the people? The presidency lost the popular vote by 3 million, and he still gets to be president. The Senate, because every state gets two senators no matter the size, so New York or California gets the same representation as North Dakota, the Senate is also controlled by the loser of the popular vote. Way more people voted for the Democratic senators than voted for the Republican senators who are there right now. The Supreme Court is very interesting because a lot of people are mad about Brett Kavanaugh. There are actually four members of the Supreme Court, all conservatives, who were appointed by presidents who lost the popular vote. George W. Bush appointed two after losing the popular vote, and maybe losing Florida. That'd be interesting to see what the last 20 years would be like if Al Gore had been declared the winner of the 2000 presidential election.
It
would
be a parallel universe.
Yeah, Back to the Future too. We'd be in right. that universe.
Right.
Probably would have a lot more solar power in New York City, is my guess. Right. But Supreme Court is controlled by conservatives, but only one of those conservatives was appointed by a president who actually won the popular vote. So you have the House of Representatives, which is in Democratic hands, which is still pretty heavily gerrymandered. They actually won the popular vote by a lot more than their control margin, representation margin is. So at a certain point, you're like, these people cheat to win. They're not trying to win by like our ideas are more popular because mm-hmm. more people agree with us. So that to me is anti-dharmic. You can't even have a discussion about what the Buddhist view of, you know, environmentalism or individual freedom or, you know, taxation of the wealthy versus, you know, capitalism until you get people in the room who basically agree that democracy should be the way that we have that discussion. And so from the standpoint of not going into a fascist state, I think we have to remove the Republican Party, and then hopefully 20 years from now, maybe have two other political parties. Maybe it'd be like a centrist Joe Biden-esque party and a more progressive Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez party. And both of those believe everybody should vote automatically, you know, that everybody should have a voice, that the winner should actually represent the people based on ideas.
My question, Eth, is how idealistic is that?
I mean, everything is idealistic until it happens.
Yeah. In other words, you know, one of the things that you could ruminate on and contemplate with what's happening, which so much of what we're experiencing is man-made, you know, human-made, even there are, of course, conspiracy theories that even the virus was made by human beings, you know. So you can take it as far as you want to go with that. A lot of the troubles that we're experiencing are, you know, sourced at the human being level. And, you know, when the first podcast I did was with Dan Goleman. And, you know, he's, you know, got his good rap on the science of how human beings work. And his main concern, he said, was that human beings are not technically wired to get a broad view of the future and implications karmically of things to come because of the evolutionary quality of the brain, that we're survival based, you know, and which is the threat and survival mode. And of course, there's a kind of new little twingy thing that's kind of like, oh, maybe we could think this through a little bit, even when you feel personally or emotionally threatened or sociopolitically threatened. But that the other thing, his concern was that the other thing is so strongly wired into us that it will actually be the, could sow the seeds of our own extinction and destruction. And, you know, people are really actually, that I know, who you know, are a variety of views about the fact that we are an evolutionary experiment that maybe isn't going to make it.
Right.
That Homo sapiens is kind of, now, from that, you get the nihilistic thing of like, it's all over. And then you get a perspective like from the shaman, like Alberto Bioldo and people like that, who are saying, yeah, it's the dawn of a new species called Homo luminous, Homo Deus, which is going to be the birth of the luminous beings, you know, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and, you know, the sort of realized beings with the luminous energy field intact. And then the, on the other side, you get people going, yeah, it's, we're dead. You know, it's going to, there's going to be worms crawling around, you know, and we'll start all over again.
Yeah. I mean, also from Daniel Goleman's own research, like in his book Altered Traits with Richie Davidson, you know, what you're talking about in terms of like hardwired, you're talking about the amygdala, right? The mm-hmm. kind of fear response. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and it is, I mean, the human brain, what I've studied of this from people like Richie Davidson, from a lot of other people, but he and Daniel Goleman are clearly at the top of the field in terms of intersecting, you know, Western science and psychology with Buddhist thought, is what they found in Altered Traits about master meditators, which is, I think, people who have meditated for like 12,000 hours in their life, is this ability, usually what happens in, say, they've also done studies, by the way, that demonstrate that Republicans have bigger amygdala than progressives. Did you
see God, that? I wouldn't want to let that get out. I mean, that's like, that's like, that is just like, man, that goes to the root of a lot of things, which people have been saying over the years on both sides about, you know, oh God. I mean, it's so deep.
Yeah. But anyway,
there's a real study that said that.
Yeah. But, I mean, I don't know how many times it's been verified or whatever, but it feels true when you know, I know what it's like to watch somebody have a fear response, and, you know, and what that means is that in a typical person is that the prefrontal cortex activity shuts down. That's my understanding from the research. Prefrontal cortex is the, let's think this through.
Yeah.
Let's be grounded. Like, do I really want to burn this bridge? What could I cultivate here? What's the most logical, you know, what's the best long-term solution, et cetera, the kind of logical planning, structured mind. And so typically in a person who doesn't have a lot of self-awareness, let's say it that way to make it apolitical, the amygdala response, like the fear, you know, like comes in and you go, holy shit, I got to buy all the Purell in the world, right? That's an amygdala response because it's not very logical. You know, it's not going to help you live longer. Even if you were a billionaire, you would want to buy Purell for every other human being. You'd be going like, everybody keep your hands really clean because I don't want to die. Right.
Yeah.
So here's some Purell. That would be the prefrontal cortex response to hoarding. Right. It's like, let's make sure everybody else has sanitation so that I don't die.
Right.
It has nothing to do with compassion per se for others. It's just kind of enlightened self-interest. Now, what they found in that study is that master meditators have a much increased ability to keep the prefrontal cortex active during an amygdala response. So the amygdala response, the fear still comes in, or the aversion still comes in, but the thinking brain is still kind of running the show, the clarified thinking brain. Yeah. It's not necessarily a monkey mind thinking brain that we all think of. Yeah. So, you know, in terms of extinction, you know, an extinction level event, it would take a lot. I mean, that's the other thing about Darwinism is, you know, most of the extinction level events that have happened in Earth's history, my understanding, were from objects from space, you know, like what killed off the dinosaurs and things like that. But the idea that like there's going to be a growing group of people who can actually work with their fear response in a more grounded and sane way, and that's going to be some kind of new body of people. Like, I mean, I think we need to be a little bit careful with this, because that's also what Adolf Hitler thought. He actually used some of the narratives and symbolism from Himalayan thought. You know, a lot of people have found like the swastika. Sometimes you look at Tibetan brocades and there's a inverted swastika on
it. Yes, indeed. Like,
but that notion that increased awareness can, you know, lead to something different, I think that's true. And the notion that, yeah, there might be a really high level of humanity that's a dominant number of humans might not be able to access that. But
it could be like a kind of new age Aryanism, you know?
Yeah, but
it's a little bit of that quality of like, oh, okay, the cool people, the enlightened, the woke people are going to waltz through the gateway on this, and everybody else is. Yeah, so anybody who has that view, I kind of want to ask them more questions. It's like, what's going to happen to the other 8.9 billion people? You know, are they just going to like wilt or what, you know, and how does that work? It's one thing to just say all these things, but it's another thing to really just be on the ground here with it.
Right. And also, if you were actually, from a Buddhist standpoint, a more woke person, you would still want to help those people.
Sure.
You just wouldn't want them to be in charge of everything, you know?
Interesting point.
And right now we have a situation where that frame of mind, that amygdala response of greed, it really is allowed to run the show, you know?
So maybe we should just break the United States into amygdalania and California. Break into two countries.
Well, I mean, the governor of California is beginning to talk about California as a nation state, you know.
He is?
Yeah, because California is navigating, you know, with the absence of a functioning federal government that we have right now, is navigating helping other Western states get the COVID supplies that they need. And I mean, he might
see what you mean. Yeah.
Taking it up a notch in terms of the rhetoric, but you know, I agree with that. He
was also quite complimentary to Donald Trump yesterday on, you know, saying that he was getting things that he needed.
Good.
So, you know, it's good to keep, you know, keep looking at things and allow for people to evolve through all this.
Do you have animosity towards Donald Trump?
Well, that's also an interesting thing. And some people have animosity towards the virus itself.
Right. Is the virus a sentient being is another interesting question.
Well, according to my sources, it's both and neither. It's sort of in the gray zone, unlike a bacteria, which is, you know, will manifest a lot of the qualities of like trying to survive. And so I've started looking at the virus as kind of, I mean, I actually, like, I could get in trouble for this, but I said, I think it's a spore from the CIA, but not the government CIA, but the actual Central Intelligence Agency of the world. It has some kind of spore-like thing. It's going out and it's affecting situations so differently, and it's provoking things and it's destroying things, and it just makes you wonder what kind of intelligence is going on behind it. But each individual little piece of the virus, I don't think it has a complete sentience to itself. So it's that doesn't seem to be the case, and they seem to be kind of more dead than alive already, and that's why it's hard to kill them. Mm. Yeah.
So it is a zombie apocalypse in that.
There's a zombie-like aspect to it. It's kind of that's fair enough. The virus. So, but what I would say, and I'm willing to change my perceptions every day in this not knowing zone, is that the virus seems to have some kind of Rorschach quality. What's happening in the world right now is bouncing people back to themselves. Mm-hmm. Just like you in a retreat, you go, oh, this is bad, that's bad. You know, and then you go, well, wait, I'm just sitting here alone. And so I'm generating the whole reality field myself. And it does seem to like magnify what people were already into. Like if they're angry, they're angrier. If they're sad, they get depressed. If they're kind of proactive, they kind of get going, you know. So I think there is a Rorschach quality to it, and I'm not sure what the inherent quality of it is. Do you have any idea?
No, I mean, it does make me think, you know, there are more cosmic forces at play. And if there is a benevolence, it's in the, again, getting back to our first topic, like there is some benevolence to being able to, you know, see yourself clearly. And I think, but that also is what makes me optimistic. That's what makes mm-hmm. me disagree with the notion that we're hardwired, because I also think when things really matter, you know, and you're in touch with things that really matter, most people's compassion is brought out. Most people's like clear thinking, like what really matters here is brought out. And that is, you know, I've been talking about this a lot, because that is also the function of Buddhism, is it's a set of spiritual, psychological, philosophical practices and contemplations that get you to what really matters. Like, let's really get into like mm-hmm. birth, you know, aging, mm-hmm. sickness, death. Like, what is life really? And how do you want to show up to that? Mm-hmm. And so I think things like this are good for awakening, in terms of it really, it is like a mirror for all of us of like what really matters. Okay. Like, you know, and it's interesting, the number of people who don't meditate, who are like, you know, okay, now you're at home alone with yourself and you can't move around very much. And what's your mind doing? You know?
Yeah. And it's interesting. The interest in that is clearly picking up. It's, mm-hmm. You know, demonstrable. You and I both teach online a lot, and there's more interest than ever in this kind of practices. So this might be a little bit of a kind of interesting exercise or not, but, you know, people always say, oh, Ethan said this, Ethan said that, you know, and it's like, I really think you have a kind of a perch, you know, in the world, and you're, and I do it. Yeah. I say, well, I wonder what Ethan thinks about that, you know, and like, or I'll quote you on something. So if you had a chance to say, to address, let's say, I'm going to give you a couple of people and you have a chance to tell them something or give them a consult or an advice, what would you say to Donald Trump, for example? Let's say you met him at tea and he said, Ethan, what do you think about what's going on? And I really want to hear it.
Yeah, I don't think he's capable of doing that, but I unless I was already like really complimenting him, you know.
Uh-huh. Okay. But, well, that could be skillful.
Otherwise, I think he would, I mean, he might say something like he just said to a male reporter who asked him a very serious question. He said, don't be such a cutie pie. So, but, you know, I think I'd just say like, I get that your life is a sales pitch, you know, and it's okay. You know, like, I don't know. I guess I would just want him to feel like he's good enough, you know? And then remove him from power.
You know? Okay. So there's nothing you would say to Donald Trump is what it says.
I mean, my analysis and my mind keeps going to the elements that brought Donald Trump into being that are kind of complicit or interdependently, you know, nobody empowers themselves.
Right.
And
Trump, so what do you want to say to those people?
Donald Trump feels fairly cut off from.
Okay. So it's hard. He's hard to talk to.
Yeah. I mean, the first group of people I want to talk to, since I know a few of them and I feel like they're, and this one's hard, but is mainstream journalists and the owners of mainstream media companies.
Can you give an example of somebody?
Sure, like a New York Times reporter or somebody who works at CNN, not a Fox News reporter, but just, you know, just to say like, look, I understand how media works right now, that you need to maximize advertising. And to do that, you need to keep his narrative alive, even if you disagree with his actions personally. But you could find another way. You could not make the stories about the things that he says that are clearly lies. You know, he's brought us all into a reality TV realm.
Right.
And it wouldn't have worked unless we were willing to go there and thought that that was the best way, you know? Right. I mean, I think it's just like, there's a lot of problems with American mainstream media, and he calls it fake news a lot. So I'm not going to go there, because they're, you know, New York Times or CNN, they're not fake news. They report on things that do happen. It's just, they always feel like they need to narrate what's happening from his perspective as well, which means they just quote a lie and he knows they're going to do that.
Right.
And so I would just say, you don't have to do that. we can find another way to support journalism. You know?
What would you say to Joe Biden?
That I really wish you had endorsed someone else. You know, but I'm gonna vote for you.
Well, but he's, let's say going forward, what would you say to him? Now that this is what it is.
Yeah. I also feel like it's most important to work on other things, like where a group of meditators is getting together, which anyone can participate in. We're calling ourselves Dharma Vote, to work on Senate races and swing states and things like that. So what I would say to Joe Biden is you have to win. If you're not dropping out, you have to win.
Right.
And you have to be sure you're going to win, and you have to make sure that happens. And you have to use every inch of your work to empower other people, to empower the next generation. Please. That's what I would say to him.
That's good. That's good advice.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting to think of, you know, these people are people like us. We don't know them. Some people do know them. I've often heard that people sometimes are in very powerful positions. When you talk to them one-to-one or individually, they have a much more mellow kind of aspect, and it's very hard being in the public world. And what? Let me ask you this, Eth. What are you telling your students and your meditation people? What are you telling them to practice more? Are you telling them to watch their mind in any particular way? What advice are you giving to people?
I mean, it really depends. A lot of people are working with a lot of anxiety, and so I do think that the two things I found very useful in terms of meditation working with anxiety, one is sometimes you need to do mindful activities that aren't meditation, like yoga or, you know, Tai Chi. Sometimes you need to find other ways to be with yourself, and that's actually okay. And you could just meditate for a short period of time. The other thing is, I think it's really important to feel supported. So I encourage people to, you know, think of their benefactors, mentors, lineage, bodhisattvas, etc., and really invite them visually into the meditation space so that people feel supported in their practice. And, you know, if you're able to, do lots of compassion meditation for yourself and for others. And also get involved. You know, I think that's the other piece of this, is a lot of the anxiety is a feeling of powerlessness, and just doing little things, I think, can actually help you feel like you are part of this world, you know, and are making it better in some small way, you know, and maybe helping it evolve into homo luminous.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, as opposed to seeing that as a kind of separatable victory from the whole situation.
Yeah.
You know, it's so great to let people know that this is just kind of like a normal conversation between you and me, and that this is what we, of course, along with family stuff and ordinary things, that we are, for me, it's unusual. I only have one son. You know, Charlie Chan had number one son, which means he had number two sons, number three sons, but I have number one son.
Which is kind of an awful parenting tactic, right?
It is. It's my number one son. Okay, what am I? Chopped liver, you know? But, you know, that we have that, obviously, that wonderful family relationship, but we really do go at the Dharma punching bag and take some swings at it and see what we can come up with. And it's, you know, I think of you as somebody who's really engaging very actively in the world that you're living in. And so I'm proud of that, and I'm happy about that, and inspired by that. And, you know, the one thing I wanted to just sort of throw out at the, see if it sticks, is from the Trungpa Rinpoche daily Mahamudra, and thinking of this to our friends out in the world as to how to maybe proceed in a time like this or any other time. He says, the fundamental requirement of Mahamudra is to preserve mindfulness and alertness at all times, both in formal meditation practice and in post-meditation. Mindfulness is the faculty of not forgetting what to do and what not to do. Alertness is the awareness that knows what is occurring. If mindfulness is lost, you will also lose alertness. And then it is no longer meditation. and then followed up by a famous quote from our ancestral teacher, Trungpa Rinpoche, that I'm sure you've heard before, the everyday practice. Oops, where'd that go? Oops. It actually switched me to another quote. The bad news is you're falling through the air. Nothing to hang on to, no parachute. The good news is there's no ground. So maybe that was meant. That's so funny. That just popped out of nowhere, ladies and gentlemen. And, you know, I want to just encourage folks out there to check out Ethan's offerings, because they're plentiful. And we'll have a link on our page to your website and your page, and your books are wonderful. And you've got teacher training programs going on and training programs going on of all kinds, and you're seeing people one-to-one. And, you know, I feel like very, very happy, Ethan, that you're, you know, we're sort of somehow ended up on a similar jag on the same airplane, whatever you want to call it. And thank you so much for the work you're doing with people, and for being such a great dad and a great friend to me.
Dad, thank you for being such a great dad to me also. And I'm actually speaking for myself in that one.
So, there you go.
You're speaking for Izzy. Yeah, it's great to be on your podcast. And, I also want to encourage people to read your new book, 'cause I think it's, really needed creativity, spirituality, and making a buck or right livelihood. And I think there's a lot of creative people right now who are trying to figure out how to find that next idea for whatever the world looks like coming next in a way that's both creative and meaningful and benefits others. So I know a lot of friends who've gotten a lot out of reading how you brought those three things together in your life and teaching. So
thanks, Ethan. And of course, we'll talk soon. Why don't you hold on for a minute? I'm just going to stop the recording and wish everybody well out there, and we'll be seeing you all in the virtual realms. Okay, bye bye.
Bye bye.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.